Thank you. Name's Pat Hilton, grateful happy alcoholic. And thank you for inviting me, Jack. It's a pleasure and honor to be here. It's an honor to be show up just about anywhere today, especially at my age. Elisa, your first year, you know, it's a fantastic deal. The only thing better than I can think of in your first is your second. So stick around. Don't give up after this first. And you talk about the change of schools and things. All I can say is dare to dream and dream big. This, you know, AA will show you, booze will show you how low you can go, and AA will show you how high you can go. There are no limits other than those you put on yourself in this program. I have learned that. I have lived that. It's an incredible journey. And, Devin, congratulations to you on your 6 years. And the only thing better than that is seven. Come back. Come back again. It's an awesome program. You know, on the way over here, I had passed this guy, and it said, honk if you love Jesus. I honked, and the guy gave me the finger. It's always it's always good to be in my group, you know. Honk if you love Bill W. I've never gotten the finger back on that one. I never know what I'm going to talk about. I've lived a long time, and I've been around here for a while. I would say that for the grace of God, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and people like you all over the planet, it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink since August the 19th of 1975. And I'm a California transplant, and I know most people think Californians are the granola state. We're either fruits or nuts or flakes, and you'll have to you'll have to figure out which one I'm in. Probably all categories. I think I'm here to talk a little bit about alcohol, what it does to you, and what happens to you if you come to AA. Alcohol, you know, I have learned it will kill anything living and preserve anything dead. It's a very powerful substance. And it's funny, it has no really shape or form. It's just a liquid, and it takes the shape of the container it's in. And this is my shape. And it's funny what it did to me. You know, it affects both my body and my mind. It's a twofold disease. It's an obsession of my mind, which is defined as one thought that overpowers all other thoughts. And when I look back at the control that it had on my life, it's incredible for me to think about that. It picked all my friends for me. It picked the places that I worked. It chose where I would go to lunch. It did every activity that I had and related and revolved around alcohol. I used to get arrested frequently, and I didn't know it was going to be a status symbol, or I kept track of some of these things a little more carefully than I did. But after I came to AA, the chief of police of Los Angeles, his bodyguard was a person I had known. They'd arrested me a few times, but he came out in the chief's white limousine, and he put me in the back seat, and they drove me around town. He said, isn't this a little more comfortable than riding around the back seat of that old black and white car you used to be in? I said, God, it is, Larry. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that take place for you. I would choose friends that only friends that drank. I excluded so many people from my life, like the local minister and the local chiefs of police. A minister called me, it was quite a few years ago now. He said, hey, Pat, he said, I got this guy over here at my place, and he says he's a drunk. I don't know what to do with him. I said, that's really good news, Joe. He said, what do you mean good? I said, well, at least he knows he is. You know, most of us have no clue. He says, well, I don't know what the heck to do with this guy. I said, I'll be over and visit with him. So I visited with him, and a few years later, Joe said, I just can't relate to people like that, Pat. So he was getting a little out of control with his weight. I said, Joe, you have some heart problems. You shouldn't be eating like that. I gave him a book on how to diet and keep himself in shape. And so he read this, and maybe 2 years later, he's in the hospital over, had a massive heart attack. I said, Joe, do you remember that drunk that was in your office and you couldn't understand how he thought? He knew what he was doing was killing him, but he did it anyway. Can you relate to your food? We had this conversation. You did it anyway. That's what we all do. Your obsession happened to be with food. Ours happens to be a little more destructive socially than the others. I've always defined myself as a drunken social drinker. And that's just never seemed to be able to handle like others. One or two was never enough for me. My favorite word was next or dos mas, something like that, you know. And it didn't matter what the subject was. I always wanted one more. Anyway, alcohol is it just wreaked havoc with my life. And before I get too far along, I want to make sure that I help you understand what AA means to me. It has given me an incredible life, a life beyond my wildest dreams. I would say if I were saying, why in hell would I listen to that old guy up there talking? What the hell does he know about anything? And you'd be right. But the thing is, I think that's one of the things we don't do enough of. You only get to see us a brief time chatting here or in meetings for a little while. You don't see how we really live. It's easy to be a good guy standing here. It's easy to stand up here and make talks. But when I go out that door there, my world changes, and I have to still be that same kind of a guy. And can I be that kind of a guy? Well, let me tell you what's happened for me, just a few things to make you really sick. I came in here in a poverty case. I ended up a wealthy man. I came in here without friends. I have a 30-year wedding marriage relationship going. The longest relationship I'd had with a wife or other, any other significant person was a couple of years before coming here. So I've never looked for a job once I came to AA. I devoted most of my time to AA and to penitentiary work and other such things. And as a result of that, I have been given this incredible life. I have had three jobs since I've been here, and eventually picked up by a billionaire out of New York. I had no idea he was even on the planet. And the phone rang, and it was him. And he wanted to meet me. And I wondered, does this guy want to meet me? I didn't even know him. But we did. And then we became business partners. But those are the things that happen. I have no applications for jobs anywhere on this planet. I just worked there, and I ran marketing worldwide for a company that I helped this fellow start. We built airplane windows for most of the airlines in the world. So as a result of that, I got to travel around the world. I've been to most countries on this globe since coming to AA. I've been to AA meetings in all those places, and the finest meeting I've been to is in Australia. And the reason I say this is because they're very civilized. You know, they serve tea in their meeting. I'm a tea drinker. I don't drink coffee. And I said, finally, a civilized meeting on this planet. You know, and they always say, let the Yank talk, let the Yank talk. I love to hear that, you know. They are lovely people, and I have one coming to see me next month for a couple of weeks. But anyway, AA has given me all these things. I have a world of friends everywhere I go. I always make a call to AA and find somebody and meet them and go to their meetings, and they show me their countries and how they live. But these are the kinds of things that I only dreamt of before. My biggest dream when I was young was to live to be 30. I told everybody I would be dead by 30 years of age, and I tried my very best to do that. I could give a damn less about tomorrow. People used to say, well, what a great man he would be if he lived until tomorrow. You know, I was always going to do something next week, tomorrow, whatever. But anyway, what was that? Is it time? Somebody, have they got the hook? Get him off there. Thank you, Carla, for praying for me. My friend Carla told me last night she was going to pray for me. I said, is the group that tough? You know? But your prayer work, they've been kind to me so far. This is one of the nicest looking groups of sick people I've ever seen. It really is. It's lovely. Anyway, AA has opened doors for me that were just beyond my wildest dreams. I often call my story a life beyond my wildest dreams, for that's what it has been. It's an incredible journey. And it's not because I'm a terrific human being. It's because I shaped up and started doing what I was supposed to do. And as a result of that, doors opened for me that were always there, but they were closed as a result of my behavior. I've defined alcoholism as a person who consumes a year's supply of anything in 2 weeks. Or a person who goes from... Sandy, please. Or a person who goes from adolescence to senility without passing through maturity. That's my favorite. And my favorite joke in the grapevine is two old men like me sitting on a bench talking to each other. He says, I wonder, when situations like this come up, I wonder how an adult would handle it. You know, that's me. That's what Devin was talking about. Quit looking for your inner child. Start looking for your inner adult. Grow up. You know, that's what I was taught to do. I've been around incredible people in AA. One of the first fellows I met was named... what was his name? This happens at this age also. Herb M. was his name. Herb had 35 years in AA in 1975 when I came in. Herb was a world-class scientist. Herb worked with Einstein. Herb won 2 Academy Awards, danced with famous movie stars, and was a concert pianist. But as Clancy used to say, but when Herb's drunk, he can't find his ass with both hands. And that's what alcohol did to Herb. But Herb said to me, Pat, he said, don't listen to those people who are concerned about the pink cloud. I have been on one for 35 years. Don't listen to those other people. I said, and when people like Herb talk, I listen. And I have said, I can tell you, I have bad moments in my life, but I don't have bad days in my life. I choose to be happy. I enjoy my happy, joyous, and free life that the book promises me. And I think it's available for all of us. It says, see to it that your relationship with right is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. Countless others. That doesn't just include Pat. It's all of us have this available to us. There's a wonderful book out, if you haven't read it, The Secret. It's exactly the way I was taught to think when I came in here by people like Herb and Betty and others. A lot of people don't like to have opposite sexes as sponsors. My first sponsor was a lady. She was 65 years old. And the reason I chose Betty is because I chose someone that I wanted to be like. I wanted some. She was a first-class socialite person who had traveled the world, who has the most interesting person I have met in my life up until now. And so she was incredibly good for me. She had about 20 years in AA at the time. I also have a man sponsor, but I started with Betty. That's kind of funny. Not long ago, I was giving a chip to a guy for his 23 years, and his sponsor was a woman. And the gal that made the talk that night was 7 years, and I'm her sponsor. I said, gee, maybe there's something to this. And you know, if they tell us not to do something, we're going to do it anyway. That's the worst thing. You can say, don't do that. Oh, yeah. I'm going to do that. Isn't that true? I mean, if you're anything like me, I hear laughter, so you must identify somehow. You know, anyway, I have all these incredible people to thank, and I'm most grateful for all those who went before me in this deal. Why? Because they could have passed the why that even I could follow it. You know, there's a lot of things you do before. There's two things especially you do before you ever get around to working these steps. You know, it says you have to want what we have and be willing to go to any lengths to get it. Then you are ready to take certain steps. People seem to overlook that and just go right in. You know, think about this whole deal. Am I really willing to commit myself? It says in there, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Bill Wilson said the only word in the whole book he would change is the first one, rarely. He said, I would say never have I seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And I would agree with that. And trouble is, we have too many people with their program. Unfortunately, there's only one program for me. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. It's in this book in the first 164 pages. Too many of us say, oh, my program, I do this. Well, your program is in here. Why don't you? I used to say to a minister, I didn't believe much in the Bible and things. He said, well, Pat, what's the gospel according to you? And I had to sit there for a while. He said, you have any followers? I said, I haven't thought about that. You know, another minister came to my door. I have these ministers somehow came into my life in sobriety. I was having dinner one night. This guy pounds on my door and he comes. I said, hi, Jim, what's up? He was amazed. He said, oh, Pat, it's my brother. He's an alcoholic. He said, can I come in and talk to you? Right, we're having dinner. Come on and join us. Sure. So he sits there, and he tells me all about his brother, and he said, oh, I've been praying for him and all this. I said, oh, that's pretty cool, Jim. First you've tried God, now you've come to me. I'm not really sick, but that's exactly what I said to him. I took his brother to me that night. There was a drawing, and he won the big book, so, and the rest is history. He's done well since. Anyway, it's kind of funny how all these things get to put, things just pop into my life that I have no idea that are even there. And that's what, my life became a life that I didn't even know was available to me. I had no clue that was on this planet and I would be eligible for that. I've learned so many things. I have learned that I've been so wrong about so many things in my life. I've learned about the word love, for example. How wrong I was in what I thought love was. I always thought I had two legs, wore a skirt, and looked real pretty. You know, that was love for me. But I have learned it's far more than that. Love to me is just the giving of your heart to wherever you happen to be and keep a smile on your face to let everybody know your heart's at home. That's the way I look at things today. I think that we're all, the thing I like about AA, it's enabled me to be very level-eyed with all human beings. I don't have to look up at you and I don't have to look down at you unless you put me up on a podium or something and you're sitting and I'm standing. But other than that, I see us all the same. That Lord's Prayer starts off with our Father, and our Father means our Father. It doesn't mean mine or yours, it's ours. And so I think all this is available to us. And some people feel they're blessed. I don't feel that. I think blessed to me is, for me, personally, it's just a little bit too egotistical. It's like I'm a chosen one, and we've picked Pat to be a really good example and give him this wonderful life, and you, I'm going to crap on you. You know, I don't think God works that way. I used to think when I was young that God just said, Pat, there's just something about you that pisses me off. I used to feel that way about it because of the way my life was working out. I didn't realize it was me. And before I get to any more of my little stories about me, I talk a little bit about God, because if in God, by that I mean, as we use it, higher power, and you can choose whatever higher power you prefer. But it's necessary that we have one. You know, if we don't think there is one, I mean, when you go home tonight, look in your mirror and stare at yourself for a little while and ask yourself, is this the most powerful thing on the planet? And if you think it is, you're sicker than you think you are. There's a lot of things more power. I used to call it HP, higher power, half pint, highway patrol, Hollywood Park. They were all higher powers to me. They all had control and dominion over my life. But, you know, in the first 50 pages there, somewhere around 48, 950, it says, the main objective of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. Now, that's the main objective, so that's kind of important to pay attention to, I would think. And so when I came in, Chris Christopherson had just written this song, Why Me, Lord? And I kind of like the words, and I don't remember them exactly, but the parts that I do remember is, why me, why, what have I ever done that was worth loving you, or something along those lines. But it said, maybe I could show somebody else what I've been through myself on my way back to you. And that's kind of the way I feel about this thing, that I have been given the ability to be of value to somebody else. You know, that's the whole job for me on this planet, is to be of value to somebody else. And as a result, it's selfish, because I feel so good doing it, you see? And when I feel good, I want some more feel good. And so that's the way it has worked out. I have to kind of always reinvent myself in this subject, though. It's up to me to make my life interesting and exciting. It isn't the world's job, it's mine. But this higher power thing, there was a book also written at that time called I Ain't Much Baby, But I'm All I've Got. Now, it's okay to read books other than the big book, because in the big book it says we realize we know only a little, and God will constantly disclose more to you and others, you know, in other meetings, in other countries, in other books. And so this Jess Lehrer book, I Ain't Much Baby, But I'm All I've Got, in there he describes his relationship. He says all we have to do is make this move from our head to our heart. It's a very short distance to travel to find that which we are looking for. And he says that, you know, it's kind of like if you're out in the woods and you're lost in the forest and you're wandering around and you look up and you see the North Star and you start walking towards that North Star, somehow you get out of the woods, but you don't ever get to the North Star. Well, that's kind of the way this God thing works, this higher power. I stopped following something that I don't understand, and somehow I got out of the woods. I got out of my troubles. Things started changing for me. Life got better. So that's the concept I use. It's more like following the North Star. I use the concept personally I like the Indian's great spirit. I think there's a great spirit that pervades all things, which works for our good. Once we get in tune with that, and it will guide and direct and make life easy. And how do we know when we're doing that? We turn our life and our will over to the care of God. What does that mean? That means our thoughts and our actions over to the care of God. To me, because a lot of person is nothing more, your thoughts become your actions become your habits become your character. That's all a person's human, all a human is. But in order for me to have tomorrow different, today is nothing more than the result of my thinking yesterday, all the yesterdays. Tomorrow is a result of the thinking I have right now. The way I'm thinking now will create my tomorrow and every day hereafter. So it's necessary. Not only is my drinker broken, but my thinker is broken. It isn't working properly. And so I have to have help. I have to understand that I don't exactly see things maybe the way they really are. Well, how do I know when I'm doing God's will or my will? I think the easiest test, for me anyway, is my will always feels really good right now, you know, and feels like hell afterwards. Whatever it is, if I want to have this big chocolate malt on the way home, it'll taste so good. But tomorrow, I'm way, and it doesn't feel as good today, you see. And God's will always hurts like hell right now, but feels terrific afterwards. So if I deny myself tonight, I'll feel really good. Tomorrow, I won't have to go through this whole thought process. And that's kind of part of my problem, is I don't fast forward enough. I don't think the consequences. I only think the moment. I did think. I'm better in most of those departments. I'm a long way from perfection. Almost 32 years doesn't get you straightened out completely, but it surely gives you a little advantage on the way I had been. But anyway, I showed up at AA in 1975, my youngest brother called me and said, "Pat, don't you think it's about time?" I said, "About time for what?" "About time you come to Alcoholics Anonymous." "I don't know what the hell you're talking about." "Pat, we talked about it 6 months ago." "I have no recollection of that, Happy." He said, "Yes, we did." I said, "Okay, well, tell me more about it." He said, "Well, let's go to a meeting." I said, "Okay, it's Wednesday night. I'd just gotten out of jail." And he said, "Let's go to a meeting." I said, "Okay, how about Friday night?" "Oh, I can't go Friday night. I have a pigeon race." Oh, I said, "Well," that was my instant resentment. "A damn pigeon's more important than your brother." So anyway, and he still thinks so. Anyway, so on Saturday night, we go to this meeting. And there was a guy named Sam. He came in. He greeted me. "Hi, Pat. Oh, we're glad to see you, Nuka. Here's a chair right here. This is your chair." And I believe that was my chair. It was a speaker meeting, a couple hundred people every Saturday night. I sat in that chair for 2 years thinking that was my chair because Mark told me it was, "Well, you've never been there. What would you know? This is your chair, Pat. We have a seat for you." So anyway, but I never forget the man's smile and the enthusiasm that he had. And then I go to a meeting on Monday night to the men's stag, where you come to save your ass rather than show your ass, and the men's stag nights. And so on Monday night, I'm there, and this guy gets up, and he came from Palmdale, 50 miles away. I said, "Oh, boy, I know why he came down here. He didn't want anybody to see him go to an AA meeting. You know, he sneaks down to North Hollywood to go to these meetings." And so he got up there, and he said, "Newcomer," he said, "if you have any problem with alcohol, you're in the right place." He said, "You don't ever have to hurt again if you don't want to." He said, "You don't have to pay any more dues if you don't want to." And he said, "If you'll give this program half as much time to half as much time as you gave to drinking, you will be a winner." I said, "My God, that would be a lot of time to give to this program." All the time I gave to drinking. But anyway, I am here today to say that what he said was so. I remember the words as clearly tonight as I heard the night I heard them. But anyway, what happened for me was that people began to make it possible for me to believe that maybe I wasn't so different. Maybe I wasn't so weird. Maybe there would be a way for me. You see, I had no concept that it was at all possible the way I was drinking, the way I was living, which I haven't told you much about because I don't care much about that part of life. I care more about how do we get our act together and get going from here. Where I've been is interesting. There's a Russian saying, every road has two directions. I went left first off, and now I'm going right. That's basically the difference in my life. But anyway, went to several meetings. I went to a meeting every day in the first week, and I went to a young people's meeting. I remember a young girl, 14, saying, she said that a coincidence was nothing more than a miracle whereby God prefers to remain anonymous. And I thought about it. Coming from a 14-year-old, that just somehow startled me. You know, it just set me back, and I had never thought about such things. But it was interesting to me that in the year that she had been there, how her thinking was so different than anyone I knew at 14, or at least me at 14. She was talking such subjects. But anyway, my insurance agent happened to be in there, and she said, "My God, Pat, rates will go down for everybody. If you didn't move, I hit you. I ran into everything, trees and freeway fences, and there was always this little alcoholic dog running in front of me. I had to swerve to miss, and I crashed." Well, I was getting arrested for this with some frequency, and one time I was out entertaining. I have to tell you this little story. I was out entertaining a customer in this big, nice restaurant in Hollywood, and we're showing off and having a great old time. And suddenly my wife and I, this is my second wife, we were in some big argument. She was from Scotland, so we're shouting at each other, and I'm really entertaining my customer royally. And I leave, and I go out, and I go to a phone booth, and suddenly there's four or five police cars circled around my phone booth. You know, it looked like one of those old Western movies where you circle the wagons, except these were police cars. And I came out and wondered what they wanted, and they wanted me. I said, "Why would you want me? I'm drunk. I'm calling a cab. You won't need one." So they put me in, they haul me down to Hollywood Precinct, you know, and I get in there, and I had to take off my clothes. I was never proud to undress anywhere, and they were making me take off my clothes and inspecting me. And anyway, they put me in this little cell. I was telling them how important I was, and they put me in a little cell here by myself. And I saw all these other people across from me. You know, there's a status symbol. That I saw a lot of people. That must have been the drunk tank, and I'm over here by myself, you know, feeling pretty cool. But I'd seen Perry Mason. I knew you could make phone calls, so I asked to make a phone call. And I started calling. I called the White House of the United States. I dialed collect, and I called, and they said they didn't accept collect calls. Well, I hung up, and I called right back. I said, "I want to talk to so-and-so." You know, and he said, "Well, so-and-so isn't here. He's at the White House on the West Coast at San Clemente." And, you know, I could finally hear what I was doing. And I said to myself, you know, Nixon's already in enough trouble. Now he's got this little drunk in Hollywood calling. I wasn't calling him, but I did happen to know his press secretary because we were fraternity brothers. He was my big brother in college, and I hadn't seen him for 10 years or more. I don't know what the hell I thought he would do for me, but it was impressing me, and I thought it would impress I thought it would impress them, and I would get out of this deal. You know, well, they didn't do a darn thing about it, but I finally called my mom and dad, and they came to get me. My poor mom, I just buried my mother last year. She lived with us for the last 25 years. I finally grew up to be the son she always hoped I'd be. But I'll tell you one thing about parents. You know, they always look for signs of improvement. Always. I never quite got to the whole mark, but at least I did make some advances for her. Anyway, my mom was one of the sweetest people on this planet. I never heard her say an unkind word about anybody in my whole lifetime. Very sweet, very spiritual woman. And anyway, she'd look at me, "Pat, what's wrong with you? What's wrong?" "Mom, I don't know. I but it's not going to happen again. I really don't know, you know." I said, "If it's just like my brother Happy, you know, he's got four kids and a wife that loves him. My wife's thrown me out. You know, he has a job and two cars, and all, my life is just falling apart. I just don't know why. If I were like Happy, I'd be okay." Well, my mom then tells me the story sometime in later years about Happy comes over a couple of weeks later, and it's 2 a.m, and he plays the same old, "If I could, you know, I'm so lonesome I could blow my brains out" kind of music and drinking. And mom would say, "Hap, what's wrong with you?" "Oh, well, if I could just be like that rascal Pat. He's out just flitting around the country. He has no responsibilities. He's having a great old time, you know." And it's funny how we always see the other person has really got what we want, and their grass is greener until we get over there and pee on it, and then it's just as brown as where we are. You know, that's kind of the way it is. But it's funny how we each thought the other had it made, you know. And I had a pal I lived with in college. His name was Larry. Larry was extremely wealthy. He got $1 million, this is 1962, got $1 million cash when he was 21 years old and drove a Mercedes 300 SLR, big fancy roadster car. Cool guy, nice guy. Pete Peterson, Hot Rod Magazine, was his best friend. They had a private booth at the Luau restaurant in Beverly Hills. I used to love to go with him, reserved for Mr. Doheny, Mr. Peterson, and Pat. My name wasn't on there, but I always thought it was, and I got to go along with him. But, you know, I said, if I could just be like my old pal Larry. Look, he's got it made. Got all this money, and everything's working great for Larry. Well, Larry died at 28, and I'm 68. So somehow or another, I got a better deal than Larry got, you know. But it just helps me understand it isn't what I've got. There's two worlds you live in. There's the outside world and there's the inside world. And there's nothing on the outside world that'll fix the inside world. Nothing. I mean, I've had all those things. I know what the things are. And they don't make me feel any better being in jail knowing I have a Cadillac and a big bank account. I don't feel any better knowing that it's all there waiting for me. I feel terrible that I'm here in jail. I didn't have those things when I was in jail, but I know that I would not have felt good about that. Anyway, I had a lot of interesting, sad things happen in my life. I remember one wife when I was, I'd taken off for the weekend. She didn't know that. I'd gone to lunch on Friday. I didn't make any announcement I was leaving for the weekend. I just happened to meet somebody and I left for the weekend, and I came back maybe Tuesday. And there was a note on my car, and it said, "Patrick, you have hurt me very deeply and I'll never forgive you." You know, it's funny to say those things, but then when I think what really was taking place, because I used to think, just leave me alone, I'm only hurting me, I'm not doing anything to you. You know, and when I look back at the hurt that I've created, the havoc in my life, you know, it's incredible. It's one of those things I was wrong about. I was hurting other people, many people. My sponsor told me when it came time to do my amends, he said, "Pat, just write down everybody you've ever met in your entire life, because either by omission or commission, you've done something to upset them." He was right. My other sponsor, my lady sponsor, always had a sign in her office up there that said, "Life's in session. Are you present?" Now that's what action is the only deal here for me. You've got to get off and get into action. If I'm born and you stick me out there on a rock and it starts raining, I'll say, "Gee, life sucks. It's raining and then it's cold and all kinds of things happen." It's my job to get off the rock. As I said earlier, I have to reinvent myself. I have to find ways to make my life more interesting. In AA, my sponsor got me assigned to one of the penitentiaries. I said, "I've never been in a penitentiary, Paul." He said, "Yeah, I know, but he said, if you'll go as a guest, you probably won't have to go as a resident." I said, "Well, what will I tell them?" He said, "Well, you tell them how to stay out of prison, because they don't know how to do that." I said, "Okay." Well, for 5 years, they had to finally throw me out of that place. Clancy actually had the thing, and they had canned him and hired me. I could see it in the grapevine. Clancy fired, Hilton hired. Well, I'm sorry, Clancy. But it's true. I did think it. But it became a second home for me. I did that for about four or five years, and I had my sponsors say, Pat, you have to give it up. You have to let the other guys have some fun, too. And I met a guy there. I took him, you know, commitments are hard for alcoholics sometimes. I have to arrange a month ahead of time people to go there, and it was about a 75-mile journey each way. And so I had five people to go. And here it is on a Friday evening, afternoon, I get four phone calls. Pat, can't make it. It's raining outside. Don't think I want to go. Oh, it's raining. It looks ugly. Nah. So four of the five didn't go. I drive down to Sambo's restaurant where I was to meet everybody. The fifth guy standing there underneath an umbrella like this, you know. He's a little guy from North Carolina. He's just standing there smiling, you know. And I thought, also, oh, God, am I glad to see you. He said, Pat, I didn't tell you I was going to go if the sun was shining. I told you I was going to go. That taught me more about commitment than anything I've learned from anybody in my lifetime. If I say I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it. I learned, it was only a month later, I got tickets to go to Dodger Stadium to see the World Series to watch Sandy Koufax pitch. But I'd already committed to make a talk on Friday night at Winnetka at the church. And I was tempted to go to the ball game. But I said, you know, I have been drunk many times in Dodger Stadium, but I've never been drunk in an AA meeting. I went to the AA meeting. Because I remembered what that one man had said to me. I didn't tell you I was going to go if the sun was shining. I don't change because a better deal comes my way or what I perceive to be a better deal. So those are the lessons you have taught me, how to behave, how to be responsible. I have no idea what time it is. I only have, as I usually tell people, two talks, 1 hour and all night, and I never know which one I've started. And I never wear a watch because I'm not too concerned with time, but I do have, oh yeah, I have a few more minutes. Anyway, the steps and sponsorship are extremely important. The sponsorship in particular. I chose my sponsors, as I told you, because it's someone whose life I wanted to be like. I like the Hallmark green. I always call my sponsor Hallmark, when you care enough to get the very best. That was their slogan, and that's what I care. I don't try to cheat myself. And I did enough of that the first 36 years of my life. I don't cheat myself anymore. A little bit more, you can go first class. And first class means I have to give up a lot of the silly things I wanted to do, you know, and just do the next right thing. And I don't always do the next right thing. I can honestly say I've done everything in sobriety that I've done in drunkenness, except go to jail. That's about the only thing I can think of I haven't done. You know, I'm sick, but I got better. I was about 90 days in sobriety, without drinking alcohol, let's put it that way, and I was taking Valium. I had taken Valium for 12 years. I didn't realize it was a Valium's Anonymous as well. It was just Alcoholics Anonymous. Chuck Chamberlain was up there talking. I said, my book don't say tear my life, my will, care over God and Valium. He said, just like that, and he's looking right at me. I said, how does he know this? Yeah, of course he didn't know that, but I thought he did, you know. So I called my sponsor. I said, oh, I've got all these Valium. I didn't realize we were giving these things up, too. I wouldn't go anywhere in the world without pockets full of Valium. I didn't like drinking in the morning. These things calm you down fast, I think. So, but a little booze on top of it is even better. But anyway, I went and I called my sponsor and I said, you know, I've made a decision. I'm going to die sober. I don't give a damn if I, they told me I could have all kinds of problems by giving this up after that length of time. They said I could fall over and die. I said, well, if I do, I do. I've made a decision. I'm going to die sober. So I got all these things out, and we stood there, and I poured them all in the toilet. All these beautiful colors were in there. My closest friends were there, and I said, oh, God. At that moment, I wanted to dive in with them. I honestly said, I think I'll just go in there. And then we flushed. Oh, I can still hear that sound. And away they went. Anyway, it was dreadful. They were gone, and I tell you, for the next 18 months, I was always in me, as I was twisting, bending my neck, it hurt. I was nervous. I sweat all the time. I just felt terrible. But I said, you know, that's just the way it is. I'm going to be sober. I made a decision. And that's the hardest part for us to do, is to get started with anything. And I don't care what it is in your life. Getting started is the hard part. So making the decision is what kills many of us. And I made a decision to go to the bathroom before the meeting started. He didn't. you see. I know, because when you get up here, you know, they say your brain is the first thing that works when you're in the formation of a child, and your rear end is the last thing. But when you get up to talk, it's always in reverse order. For somehow, this end wants to work, and this one quits. But once you make the decision, you know, yes, I will, no, I won't. Oh, yes, no, yeah. That's what drives us nuts. Just make the decision, get on with it. Set your goal and go. There are a number of stories that I like that I have to tell you before I leave tonight, because I haven't heard them today and I love these stories. There's one who about this fellow who was an illegitimate child, and he was very ashamed of himself, and he always walked around like this, looking at the bottom of tops of his shoes and couldn't look anybody in the eye, he said. He said, and he was in church one Sunday morning, the new minister was there giving the great sermon, and he said, well, he said, I think I'll beat it out of here before the church ends, because those ministers get back there and shake your hands pretty quick. But anyway, the minister beat him back there, and he said to the young man, he said, young man, he said, whose child are you? He said, never mind, I can see you're a child of God. Go and claim your heritage. Now, he said that one sentence changed his entire life. He twice became the governor of the state of Tennessee, because he knew who he was. He knew he was the child of God. So I always tell people, careful what you say to other folks. I have the belief of give them strokes, not pokes. We've been kicked in the ass enough by the time we get out. I don't need one more guy to tell me I'm a jerk and an idiot. I know that. I need somebody to give me a great big old hug and say, you know what? You can do it too, guy. There's a place here for you. You know, and that's what AA did. They made a place for me, and they made me feel at home. They made me feel welcome. No matter what I said or did or thought, I was at home. And so for that, I will always be grateful. That's why I say I'm grateful. I'm happy because I choose to be happy, because I do the things that make me happy. It's kind of like Bill when he showed up to Bob, you know. I mean, Dr. Bob said, I don't think you can help me. Bill said, I'm not here to help you. I'm here to help me. And that's why I come all these meetings that I go to today. There was a period of time I didn't go to AA for a couple of years. I still sponsored lots of people and do all kinds of things with AA. But I'd taken an awful lot from my family. I went to AA a lot. I did a lot of things in AA, and I still do a lot of things. But there, at the time, I took a couple of years off just to hang around my family a lot more. I went occasionally, but I can live without AA, without coming to a meeting. But I don't like it. I think it's so much more fun to be here with my own kind. You see, I think that's a part of the story of, I think, I didn't feel worthy enough to have a higher power. Let's put it that way. I think I was so low in the way I was living my life that I didn't feel deserving of a higher power, so I could disbelieve there was a God. If I don't think there is one, then I don't have to worry about what I'm doing, because I don't have to measure up to anything. But anyway, I finally come to believe that there is something going on, something, and I have to behave myself, and I forgot what the hell I was going to talk about. Cindy, I'll just talk about your laughter. Well, whatever it was important, but I'll get it next time. I spoke out here about 2 years ago, and I'm really surprised I hadn't stomped out the whole damn problem, but it's gotten twice as big, so I don't know what happened. Anyway, whatever I was going to talk about, it was very distracting. I told you that 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, and I told the story, and Doug goes, she laughed and laughed and laughed so much that I couldn't even think about it. I guess kept hearing Cindy laugh. Me too. Anyway, there's a story of the two. I said I was undeserving. I was not worthy of having a God of my understanding or a higher power. But when I read this other story about the two brothers who lived together, and one stayed home and made his dad as happy as he could be, his parents, he did everything they wanted him to do, and the other one ran off to Florida and he spent his money on wine, women, and song, and just frittered away and ends up living with the pigs. You know, which is very demeaning for a Jewish fellow to have to live with hogs. And anybody for that matter, but especially for that religion, because they don't like pigs. They're unclean animals. But anyway, and maybe they are. But anyway, he decided to go back home, and there was his dad. Sees him coming from afar, and his dad runs to greet him and gives him a new robe and a big ring and throws a huge party for him. You know, and because it showed the father's love for his child was no less, because he didn't do everything his dad wanted him to. And I'm told the one who stayed at home was the founder of Al-Anon. I'm not sure if that's true. It's a rumor. It may not be true. It sounds reasonable, though. Anyway, but that helped me understand. And when I think of King David in the Bible, so let's talk about that for just a moment. Here is a guy who committed adultery, murder, and a host of other sins, yet remained one of God's chosen people. He was highly favored. So that helped me at least come to the belief that although I had made many mistakes, there is an all-loving, all-powerful, all-forgiving higher power who could accept me as a human being subject to lots of frailties. And so that helped me then develop this relationship that grows in time. And my friend Herb that I mentioned earlier said to me, Pat, reserve the right to change your mind. For as you grow in AA, as you mature spiritually, mature emotionally, your concepts and thoughts and ideas will change. I used to worry about, where did I park my car? You know, I can't remember where it is. And now I worry more about what's happening on our planet and what's happening with crystal meth and all these other kinds of things. I'm as confused as I've ever been, but the subject matters have changed dramatically on what I think about. And is it time? I hate looking at this, but oh yes. Anyway, the last little story I will tell you. Well, first I would say, if you don't know me, you haven't really missed anything. But if you don't know God, you have missed everything. And I don't mean that in a religious sense. I mean that in a concept of someone to help guide and direct when your life falls apart and there's nobody else around and you're in the foxhole. Help. You know, there is a way for us. There is a hand. There is someone who will reach out. And I see it in the eyes of everyone I've ever seen in AA along the way from Skid Row to here. I always find the eyes of love hanging around. And this is the kind of real love that exists for me, is that when one human being is just being another human being and sharing where we really live, as opposed to talking about whether or not it's going to rain tomorrow. You know, we talk about where we really live. And then we attach very deeply as a result of that. And I think it's a wonderful feeling to attach to your fellow man or woman, however you want to see that. But anyway, it reminds me of this last story that I must tell you, because it's a story I haven't heard today, and I love this story. It's been told by lots of guys, but I like the way I tell it best. Anyway, no, it's about the auctioneer, and he's auctioning off the violin. He brings out this crusty old dirty violin. He brings it out. The strings are dangling. The bow is twisted and warped. And he screeches, makes a couple of noises with it, and starts the auction. What am I bid for this? He hears $1, $2, $3, and that's about it. The bidding ends. Whereupon an elderly gentleman gets up out of the audience. He walks up to the stage. He takes it. He blows off the violin, cleans it up a little bit, adjusts the strings, tunes it, and begins to play. And the most incredible music they've ever heard starts. They can't believe this beautiful music. The bidding starts again. $10,000, $50,000, $100,000. And you ask, what is the difference in those two scenes? It's the touch of the master's hand. Well, I relate that to what happens to us here in AA. When we came here, we would sell our blood, our bodies, $1, $2, $3, $4. But when you come here and you get a grasp of a handle on this AA situation and you find out what's really available for you in your life, the bidding starts again. And the bidding becomes priceless. And you ask me again, what's the difference in those two? It's the touch of the master's hand. And with that, I thank you. Good night.